The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist.
You're listening to Radio Aryan.
Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. Tonight we're going to deal with a topic that my listeners know is absolutely central to who I am as a professional, and that is the nature of Holy Russia and its agrarianism. Russia and Ukraine are two countries dominated by the agrarian idea. This shows up in literature and political theory, but the agrarian concept is one of the most central and healthy elements of Eastern European society and serves as the basis for distributivism and Christian socialism, which, you know, essentially is just another word for that. By 1900, Russia is in some trouble. Russia, by the turn of the century, shows many parts of its life to be increasing in wealth and industry, and yet peasants are struggling. The liberation of the serfs in 1861 left peasants worse off than before. From 1861 to 1900, the average amount of land farmed by a peasant family is shrinking. A population is growing rapidly, and one way that the government tries to deal with it is to offer free land and tools and seed for any peasant that goes to Siberia. Most of Siberia, as you know, is lush and fertile, and only the northern part is frozen most of the time. It's true that the growing season is very short, but that's been a part of Russian agricultural life from the very beginning. I think that Russian intellectuals and churchmen, after 1861, became very worried about Russian life, because the freeing of the serfs and the creation of the possibility of peasant businesses, of peasant economic development, and then later on, the possibility of peasant individual land ownership, these were all dashed. I think that the average peasant in Russia under the communal system is probably better than most peasants in Western Europe. America was different because of the huge amount of land in the Midwest and the West. But at the same time, the freeing of the serfs in 1861 did not provide Russia with the conclusions that they thought it would provide. You know, the peasants did not get better in terms of their land ownership. Peasant practices in terms of technology and plowing methods did not change. Peasants showed themselves to be quite vehement in their opposition to any kind of government action on their behalf. And the peasants, very importantly, viewed the lower officials of the imperial bureaucracy to be very corrupt. It's one of the problems in any defense of the Russian monarchy, that the royal house on the one hand and the bureaucracy on the other seem to be radically different. The Tsar had a nominal control over the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy was, these were largely career scholars and writers, public officials who were very difficult to control. The bureaucracy had its own life. The bureaucracy had its own interests. And it's quite often the peasantry in Russia and Ukraine that the peasants realize this. The Tsar is not a bad guy. It's the bureaucracy. It's the mid-level of the nobility. It's the economic system, the opening up of Russian products to the West. This is what's creating the dislocation. The Russian peasant also has no real concept of property. You know, in the Western sense, I mean, there's a very specific concept of property in the Anglo-American tradition where an individual, as an individual, controls a certain object. That individualism doesn't exist in the Russian communal mentality. A group of like-minded people can work on a piece of land. They could improve it. they could earn a living from it. That's not necessarily the same thing as being able to control it outright. The fact is that the absentee landlord was always something vehemently opposed by the peasant mentality. The concept of ownership was in use, not in some legal contract, especially not on the basis of individualism. The Russian peasant after 1861 was in this very amorphous state. They hadn't developed into the yeoman farmer like so many had hoped, but additionally, they had not become strictly proletarians either. And I think the bulk of peasants, although their yields were increasing, were very unstable economically, and the government was very worried about one of the main concerns of the imperial government after 1861 was keeping peasants from becoming proletarians. The yeoman idea was extremely significant in the monarchy, in that a stable monarchy has to be based on a kind of a mixed land ownership. It could be individuals, parishes, extended families, communes, groups of communes, or the volosti. It really didn't matter. The point was that peasants, the overwhelming majority of the Russian population, have some kind of control over land and tools that can create a basic middle-class mentality that would definitely be strongly royalist on the one hand, but also oppose the growing speculation, the capitalist usurers who were moving into Russia at the same time. And Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard, which is one of my favorite Chekhov pieces, deals with this in great detail. And in my book on Russian literature, I have an essay on The Cherry Orchard as really Chekhov's attack on the modern usurious capitalist mentality that had no loyalty, that had no attachment to land or people, and lived his twisted life making money on the basis of other people's labor. The Russian merchant class, as it developed after 1861, was considered by the peasantry just as evil and corrupt as lower-level bureaucrats. This oligarchy of corn merchants were able to manipulate prices and speculate on these commodities. The average peasant saw the market, in the sense that we would use the term, as well as a state defined as a bureaucracy, as the two pillars of evil that are oppressing and destroying the peasant and the peasant mentality. There is a small class of peasants that develop into usurers and moneylenders, and they are slowly but surely placed in control due to their income of the peasant commune and of the peasant county or the volos system. Increasing stratification, the different classes of peasants, is slowly becoming fact. By 1871, 10 years after the liberation, between 10 and 15% of peasants had become proletarians. That is to say, did not own land, did not own the means of production, and only had their bodies and their skills to trade for some kind of living. The state is now the main entity in charge of dealing with new industries. Profits are going to foreign banks, and the regulations of these industries are coming from the state. This period of time also sees a huge increase in the money supply in Russia and the beginning of inflation. You need to remember that in the Middle Ages, in Western Europe, between the year 1000 and the year 1400, the value of the Western royal currency had not changed. Inflation was not part of that life, and so labor retained its value. What's happening in Russia is that as the money supply goes up, the nature of Russian labor becomes harder and harder. Their labor is worth less and less. The corn merchant mentality, both Russian and foreign, urban merchant, is seen as the absolute worst of the peasant mentality. They are manipulating prices. They are manipulating the legal system so that they can monopolize more and more land and tools to themselves. I mean, the peasant is a relatively simple person. He does not understand, nor does he care about, the legal nuances that one of these people can use. The law is seen by the peasant as a method by which their land is being stolen. Their law is within the commune. It's the church tradition, feast days and fast days. It's the commune where everybody has a voice. That is law. And yet this new class of usurers moving in after 1861 is using every kind of legal trickery to take more and more of the land and, of course, its produce for themselves. Officially, the state is opposed to this sort of thing. The monarchy condemns this kind of activity, and yet controlling it is extremely difficult. And this class of usurers slowly but surely is taking over farmland. Now, sometimes in the literature on this topic, there are people who are so bent on blaming the monarchy for everything that they act as if this is royal policy. Nothing can be further from the truth. One of the biggest problems in 19th century Russian history is how difficult it is in a country of that size, with those kind of weather patterns, to enforce the law. It's very difficult. The local governors are basically independent, and the state requires them for local information. The peasants always relied upon their political power to be found both in the commune and in that group of communes, or the volost, or I guess something like a county. They had their own courts. They were close to local monasteries, who often owned quite a bit of land and always had granaries for emergencies. But this is slowly coming under attack. The real problem with this Stolypinite idea of liberating the peasant from the commune, as I wrote in the Third Rome, as I've been preaching for a long time, because this has so much relevance to our own day, that destroying the commune meant that the ruling class would be able to deal with the peasant as an individual. A peasant as an individual had absolutely no chance against the ruling class, usurers, rich peasants, urban banks, foreign capital. The concept of individualism is so absurd in this context. What the peasant needed and what they wanted was a strengthening of their communal institutions, because a commune or a volos going up against the usurer is a far different fight than a peasant by himself. In the case of the volosti or the commune, they had their own scribes, they had their own legal minds. It was a relatively strong peasant institution which existed nowhere else in the world at that particular period of time. I mean, Alexander II thought that the commune should be strengthened, not eliminated, because the commune always makes sure that its members have the land and tools that they need. That was the great victory of the communal idea in Russia. The commune guaranteed land to its members. It guaranteed a great degree of poor relief if necessary. It guaranteed the tools and other capital that people required to work. It took care of widows and orphans. And it took its troublemakers and sent them to the army. So the commune was an extraordinary institution. Alexander II and so many other monarchs wanted to see independent, and that it could balance off the bureaucracy on the one hand and the upper and middle levels of the nobility on the other hand. The mentality of people like Tsar Nicholas I was that the bureaucracy is a problem. The bureaucracy blocks my will. It's very difficult to deal with these people. You're talking about thousands of career bureaucrats, often of high rank. To consider the monarchy absolute is absurd. In fact, people like Nicholas I, Alexander II complained about that their will was always frustrated. Local governors, the upper levels of the nobility, bureaucracy, the growth of usury and capitalism, all of this had hemmed in the monarchy, and the peasants had this concept. They understood they were the only class in Russian society who knew this, that the monarchy cannot penetrate these layers of bureaucracy, nobility, and now foreign capitalism, especially given the czarist desire for the development of railroads. Railroads became the czarist priority in the second half of the 19th century, but that required, I mean, as rational as that concept is, that required a lot of foreign capital, It did require a strong level of state control over the investment, but profits of Russian labor were not going to the state, were not going to the workers, it was going to foreign capitalists. So these are the social strains that are developing, and so Dostoevsky called himself a Christian socialist, in the sense that he wanted, real peasant yeoman proprietorship. So this kind of agrarianism, Christian socialism, is based on some version of distributivism. Now, the Christian socialist movement, and Dostoevsky was one of its main spokesmen, did not reject private property. But it certainly rejected the concept that a group of foreign capitalists should control the productive apparatus in Russia, and that was slowly becoming the case. This exact same battle, although with far worse results, occurred in Russia after the Soviet Union went out of existence, where a good portion of the Russian economy and the product of the Russian worker went into the hands of a handful of oligarchs, disproportionately Jewish, and much of this was then scurried out of the country. And this was done under the protection of the IMF and the World Bank. It was done under the protection of the United States, Harvard University, and these institutions that were heavily involved in this massive transfer of wealth from 1991 to when Putin took over in 1999. So the struggle that Russia is going through after 1861 is very similar to what occurred in after 1990. The idea is that oligarchs, speculators, bankers, much of which is foreign, some of which is internal, are using and manipulating the economic and legal system to cheat peasants out of their land, out of their produce, and are monopolizing the sort of market access of communal products. And so the average peasant sees this kind of new growing capitalist economy as a complete disaster, and they're seeing it in some kind of union with the bureaucracy. So the peasant trusts the church, especially the monks and the czar, and puts those institutions up against the bureaucracy, the nobility, the capitalist, the Jewish financier, the kulaki, or the rich peasants. And so this kind of battle, which is historically accurate, is working itself out in the mind of the peasantry. And in fact, the peasants are the only group in Russian society that actually have it right concerning the nature of the corruption that's going on. It is not the monarchy. It's the monarchy being surrounded by bureaucrats and nobles who he requires for information and support. And yet, of course, they are really pursuing their own interests. I'll repeat this. I mean, the Russian monarchy is far from absolute in this period of time. In fact, they are hemmed in by so many immensely powerful forces that their freedom of action was highly truncated. Okay, we're going to take a break here. We will return and continue this work on the nature of Russian agrarianism and peasantry and peasant philosophy in the second half of the 19th century.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We are dealing with Russian agrarianism, and what might be called the peasant philosophy and the agrarian Christian socialist vision of much of the peasant and those who support the peasantry, and in particular its communal organization. Peasants are finding themselves increasingly in debt. As this occurs, peasants begin paying back their debt by labor and with labor. This means the second half of the 19th century, up until World War I, a new serfdom has developed that often does not get the scholarly attention that it should. Increasing indebtedness, the increasing dominance of usury in Russian life, means that peasants are paying back these people with work. That is identical to the concept of serfdom that is condemned normally prior to 1861, but is slowly reforming itself, although under very different auspices, after 1861, after the liberation of the serfs. So we could summarize this concept here in seven general points. Number one, the monarchy is not seen as the enemy. The bureaucracy and the new capitalists are seen as the problem. Number two, again, just like in 1990, the peasants are seeing freedom as a concept, as a philosophical concept, as an excuse, as a cover by the new capitalists to manipulate the peasantry and to manipulate everyone who gets in their way. That free markets, freedom of economic investment is seen as a very convenient cover for the increasing exploitation of the peasant class. And I should also note to you, you should notice that the lower levels of the nobility in this period of time are slowly disappearing. The lower levels of the nobility are no different than really the peasants. They may have an ancient title, but the lower nobility is really one with the peasant class because they are looked down upon by mid-level and upper-level nobles. It should also be noted that outside of foreign capital, the relationship between the nobility and the state on the one hand and the nobility and the new economic elites on the other can be problematic. The Petersburg bureaucrats are noble because of their government service. And it's kind of a cliche in Russian studies to say that the service nobility, these people who are serving the government in St. Petersburg, are often at war with the nobility that derives its authority from their family going back many generations. They're both noble, but two very different sets of interests and two very different sets of political ideas. Number three, increasing social stratification. When a country opens itself up to usury and debt and capitalism, the increasing dominance of one particular group of economic elites will become very pronounced. That happens the same time the bulk of the population goes into debt. Debt is a weapon, but debt is used as a weapon under this ideological cover of some kind of equality, equal rights, equality before the law. Equality before the law and the peasant mentality just meant that those who knew how to manipulate the law would always win. All of these things were just covers for economic dominance. Point number four, the Tsar is losing power. The Tsar is losing power to the banks, to the railroads, to the bureaucracy, to the constant floating of foreign loans, often from France. And the major European bankers are now established in Russian territory. The Tsar is increasingly seeing his freedom of action vitiated. Point number five, the market really is about the creation of this new class, both domestic and foreign. The market is a means whereby the wealthy are able to justify and increase their power over everybody else. These are not abstractions. It's one of the key elements that in so many of my writings over the years that these sort of legal and philosophical concepts should never be seen just as abstractions. They are applied and used by people who seek to manipulate their content for the sake of their power. So things like markets and individualism and a constitutional rule and this kind of thing, these are all methods whereby the wealthy are seeking to justify and ritualize their wealth and power. Point number six, there is this concept of self-interest. This idea that things like interest and the way that the bankers operate are kind of clever ways to constantly siphon money off from the productive elements of the population and bring them to the non-productive elements of the population, including the development of a speculative elite who makes tremendous profits based on the labor of others. And finally, point number seven, there is this move that in social life really can't be exaggerated. There's a move from concrete elements of production, farming, artisan work, working on technology, you know, actual skill, real labor in the sense that any normal person would use the term real labor, where you put your skill to some raw material and produce a good that is worth something. That direct concept of labor, the very concrete idea of labor, is giving way to this abstract set of concepts like money, like interest, like debt and interest being able to be bought and sold on an open market, manipulating interest rates. These more abstract elements in the economy are quite mysterious to the peasants, quite mysterious, I think, to most people who don't know how this works on a macro level. This concept of inserting this huge empire with tremendous natural resources and a tremendous population, bringing that into the world economy just means that Russia ends up being the hinterland of the dominant European urban elite. That slowly but surely, any modicum of economic independence is disappearing because this new capitalist class of many different backgrounds is slowly siphoning the money from actual real labor and bringing it onto European markets with stocks and money markets and everything else. This move is attacked, as I've said in many places in this radio show, in my own writings. Dostoevsky is the main writer who is condemning this movement on the basis of a Christian socialism and distributivism that he backs. He doesn't see the socialist in the atheist, materialist sense as any different. Dostoevsky will predict that if this group of people takes over in a revolution, all they're going to do is simply take the productive capacity of the peasants and monopolize it for themselves. And that's, of course, precisely what happened. The Bolshevik Revolution is a massive, probably the greatest mass transfer of wealth in history from an entire empire to a relatively small elite in Moscow, the party and the party apparatus, who, of course, had full control, according to the principles of Marxism-Leninism, had full control over the economy, which is probably the greatest transfer of wealth in history, where the entire wealth of the country then came under the control of the party in Moscow. You see this occur at a slightly smaller scale in the domination of the oligarchs after 1990. I mean, the one thing that all of these things have in common is that the state, in the true sense of the word, when I say state, I'm not necessarily talking about bureaucracy and the police. I'm talking about the concepts of justice, the concepts of right and law that have developed in a particular society. The monarchy represented that, but at the same time, the bureaucracy is making war on that. And the peasants are the only group of people to really grasp that idea. And that should impress you, I think. The concept of bureaucracy is also a substantial idea here. The problem of bureaucracy is that it functions the same way no matter what kind of political system the country has. In a liberal democracy, politicians may run for office. Some get elected, some don't. This generally has absolutely nothing to do with how the bureaucracy functions from day to day. The monarchy is the same way. You can't deal with a massive bureaucratic apparatus that is run by the most powerful elite in the country, taken together with their own specific interests. The bureaucracy doesn't alter its nature, its size, its sense of entitlement and right and justice. No system of government can dispense with it. The bureaucracy in Imperial Russia was not under popular control. It was barely under royal control. And yet, of course, there is no bureaucracy that's under popular control anywhere. The bureaucracy was formally answerable to the Tsar pro forma. But that's it. In actual Tsarist impact, the Tsar could not operate without the bureaucratic organization in one kind or another. I don't want to necessarily exaggerate the point that the new capitalists are in league with the bureaucrats. While there is some cooperation, I think it would be an exaggeration to say that they are, in essence, one and the same class. The peasant mind saw them as operating together based on the idea that they relied on coercion, whether it be political or economic. Coercion is coercion. They saw that they operated in an antisocial way. They did not represent anything but themselves. So in the peasant mind, joining the new capitalists, the bureaucracy, just made sense, even if it wasn't literally true, because they both operated according to the same antisocial mechanism. And I'm using the word mechanism deliberately and technically. This is not this organic authority that the commune and the church develops over time. No, this is a machine that is artificial and has its own self-interest and is capable of imposing itself on the country. In many ways, the imperial bureaucracy is opposed to the new capitalist because there is this jockeying for power. You have a group of people who derive their power from bureaucratic membership and the mastery over the mechanisms by which the bureaucracy works. And then there are those whose power derives from money. And that, more specifically, means people who rule by manipulating the labor of others. Now, whether that is to be represented in a stock certificate or in a bundle of cereal grains or whatever, it's all pretty much the same thing. You know, money markets are about extracting surplus value from the laboring population. In this case, we're talking about the peasants. That's what all of this stuff is about. We're talking about the domination of a non-productive group of people. I wrote in my Third Rome, and you know, there's a lot about that book that I would retract, and I do have a show on here about what I have, not so much retracted, but modified fairly substantially. One of the things I said is that the very pompous academic condemnations of the Duma and the Tsarist manipulation of the Duma really is misinformed. Russian democratic elections for the first, second, third Duma were highly manipulative. The average voter did not fully understand the nature of these platforms. The nature of these platforms would be described differently in different parts of the country. You have radical leftists claiming that they wanted to give property to the peasants, which, of course, was an outrageous lie. They transferred all property to the state. And these people are receiving peasant support because the peasants are going by what they say rather than what they mean. No matter how the Tsar may have interfered with it, however it was operational, from the first, second, third, fourth, they operated under different principles electorally each time. Duma ultimately was a group of rich people who were able to buy the votes of a large number of people. They would seek to represent certain groups for the sake of attracting that kind of money and attention that is required for any kind of election. So it simply doesn't matter how the electoral law was organized. And you know, one of the big complaints of those like Pobedonostsev and others who were connected to justifying and understanding the Tsarist rule, royal rule, it was about money. It was about power. It was about manipulation. It was not, under any circumstances, about representation. You know, the Tsar may not have been elected, but there's every reason to believe that it was representative of the common Russian peasant. Now, the Council of Empire is something like the Tsar's Senate. It doesn't get tons of attention. It has 200 members, and normally it is made up of the best legal minds in the country. 50% of the membership is appointed by the monarchy. The other half is appointed by public bodies and organizations like the Zemstvo, like the local regional authorities. They were bureaucratically minded, but they were close to the court. The Senate was largely a juridical body, more than a legislative body. But czars were very dependent on them because they had, first of all, the knowledge of local institutions, and second of all, the legal structure that the czar has to operate within. And so the Senate is of immense significance in the czarist life. And it was really a problem for the czar to go over their heads and institute law, because the growth of the legal profession and the significance of the reform court system after 1861 means that the legal minds in Russia had a tremendous amount of influence. It was very difficult for the Tsar to go over their heads, although technically he could. That was a real problem in practical terms. And for people like Pobedonosiev and others who were defending the Tsar in this period of time, the question is that even if Russia were to fully become a representative parliamentary democracy, nothing would really change. That same group of educated bureaucrats would simply turn into politicians and get elected that way. The bureaucracy would not change in any way, since bureaucracy is not normally under any kind of democratic control. Well, the whole thing was based on fraud. Whether or not these people are appointed by the monarchy, whether or not they are educated in the bureaucratic ways and end up serving that way, or whether they are democratic politicians, it's the same group of people who would have been elected to a parliament as those who then staff the bureaucracy, whether at the federal or local level. It really simply doesn't make any difference. The rule would have been exactly the same. Just how that rule would have justified itself would change. And either way, you would have had the same group of people ruling the country, because even the mid-level nobles ran the gamut of opinion. Upper-level nobles. I mean, you had conservatives, you had liberals, you had Christian socialist types, you had religious types. The nobility represented every shade of opinion, much of which was, at least to some extent, anti-monarchist. So this whole thing about not having a democratic society and all this, it's just based on fraud. The same group of people would have then been elected that was appointed to bureaucratic positions, or who simply were educated in the bureaucratic way. The bureaucracy as such would not have changed. So how an elected Duma would have done against the bureaucracy, probably worse off than the monarchy against the bureaucracy. Either way, bureaucratic rule would not have changed. And even places like France and Britain, a bureaucracy is extremely large. It just doesn't make any difference how the politicians are elected. If they're elected, if they're appointed, it's the same group of people one way or another. Okay. Russian agrarian life, 1905, 1906, one of the Russian revolutions takes place. Because of the failures in the war with Japan, British financing of Russian opposition groups, the Tsar is under siege, 1905 and 1906. The situation, this period of time between this first revolution and then the Bolshevik revolution, including World War I, we could typify it this way. First of all, factory life was only done three seasons. The summer, the factories didn't operate because they couldn't operate. It would have gotten so hot with that kind of machinery that it simply would be impossible to work. Russian cities were largely deserted in the summertime. Summertime was a time where a lot of that kind of work simply did not occur. The older noble estates are shrinking. This is a case largely in the middle and lower level nobility, many of which were anti-bureaucratic. The Slavophile movement comes from this. Their land allotments are shrinking. The new capitalist mentality is at war with this older poorer noble idea. Many, many thousands of noble families in Russia were no richer than their peasants. So if you say, you know, the nobility did X, Y, and Z, that doesn't tell me anything. The upper levels of the nobility had a tendency to be liberal and Western. Lower levels of the nobility had a tendency to be Russian nationalists. So it's conceivable that we can unify the interests of foreign capitalists and the upper levels of the nobility, possibly including the membership in the Senate. But the nationalist and agrarian idea and the Christian idea may largely find its roots in the lower nobility. But this is exactly that group of nobles who are now massively in debt, are losing land, and are completely losing influence. Again, Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard is a play that you should read. It's really painful because the revolution is occurring simply by buying up of land. The revolution is occurring because this capitalist class that has no loyalty, that has no virtue whatsoever, is buying up the land that belonged to the nobility, and in the poor nobles were exactly that class of people that were backing a royal and nationalist representative Russia. As that class began to disappear, Russia began to be this, you know, a bureaucracy and capitalist on the one hand and the mass of the peasants on the other. This in-between group of lower-level nobles probably represented an extremely virtuous element of Russian society, a strongly patriotic and religious element of Russian society. These men, these families are extremely vulnerable. And they're losing land, they're massively in debt, and consolidation of economic and political power is occurring everywhere in Russia, whether or not the Tsar is interested in it or not. I mean, Tsar Nicholas II comes to power anti-capitalist. He comes to power backing the mentality of the lower nobility. He comes to power wanting to see an increase in peasant holdings, an increase in the power of the commune, everything that he could think of to keep Russia from falling into the hands of the oligarchs, and yet he failed everywhere. He failed everywhere because he didn't have the power to make it work. He was not an absolute monarch. He was greatly hemmed in by the moneyed classes, by the powerful, by foreign bankers, and increasingly these people who are controlling the railroads, which were one of the main priorities of the Russian government. Peasant schools and peasant journals are growing. This often gets no attention in the historical literature, but communes, volosti, journals of with peasant poetry, sort of rustic ideas, are everywhere. The peasantry and the larger parishes have regular schools. The volost has its own school system, and the zemstva, representative, both noble and peasant institutions, also have their school system. Fact is that peasants are growing greatly in literature and in literacy, and both peasant schools and peasant journals are showing up everywhere. Villages were very diverse places. You had people who were strictly agrarian. You had people who were working as artisans, as working on cottage industries. The fact is, not only were these villages completely ruled by democratic election through the commune as well as through the volost, with a division of power, by the way, and checks and balances in the zemstvo system, which had the upper house, which was kind of mid-nobility, the lower house, which was peasantry. So you had a strong constitutional rule at the local level. Really, the main concept, the average peasant mentality, was, in very vague terms, Christian socialist. On the one hand, they believed in the faith completely. On the other hand, they believed that every peasant family should have land and the tools required to make a living. These social instincts were absolutely dominant. Peasants were apolitical in the sense that they didn't care about party. But one thing that often gets very conspicuously avoided in discussions of Russian peasant institutions is their folk poetry. And you read the folk poetry of the Russian as well as the Ukrainian peasant, it becomes very clear that these people are extremely nationalist. They're Christians. They're socialist, at least in the distributivist sense of the word. They're royalist. In the folk poetry in Russia and in Ukraine, it is highly political, but it's political in the sense that it deals with broader concepts of justice. They don't care about political parties. The peasant mentality was based on some form of a national Christian socialist kind of idea. And so it's one thing, the peasants in Russia, through all of their poetry and their art at the local level, they are highly social and they are highly ethnic, especially in this religious sense. And it's very easy to go and find the political mentality of the peasants by finding all of their work in poetry and peasant art, rustic essay writing in Russian, Ukraine, Belarus. This stuff is everywhere. The problem is if you're a typical academic and you want to believe that you're supporting the peasantry in Russia and that they should have equal rights, everybody, you'll find out that if these peasants got elected, guys like him would be hung. These people can't in any way claim to be working in the interests of the peasantry. The so-called Russian populist movement, with people like Harrison who talk all the time about the commune, there's a shadow to that. Yeah, they may have been interested in the commune, but only a radically rebuilt commune, connected to the state, completely secular, completely mechanistic. People like Herzen and those who supported so-called communal rule did not accept the commune as it existed. They wanted to rebuild the commune and make it into simply a machine for the various radical parties to control. Not in the least bit in the interest of the peasantry. Fact is that these leftists, no matter what their public pronouncement is, these leftists believe the peasant was ignorant and backward. And when they talk about education, they knew that peasants had many, many, many schools throughout the empire. It could be church-related, zemstvo-related, volost-related, even commune-related. That's not what they mean by education. When they say we need to educate the peasants, it means we have to bring them to our point of view. They see that peasant literacy is increasing. They read peasant journals, of which there are many hundreds, and they see that the peasants essentially don't agree with them. They do believe in a better distribution of property, but that is couched in very Christian and very ethnic terms. There is a myth, by the way, of Russian drinking. Actually, Russian alcohol consumption was one of the lower in Europe at the end of the 19th century. In terms of per capita alcohol consumption, Britain, Switzerland, Italy, and France were far ahead of Russia. I just wanted to throw that in as an aside because it's one of these perfectly acceptable stereotypes, especially when you're dealing with the peasantry. You have this prejudice. The peasants were too drunk to do anything. That's garbage. The peasants did not drink nearly as much as other Europeans did. And there is a small literature on peasant drinking patterns that show that the only time they drank to excess were on things like name days, local fairs, that kind of thing, weddings. Only on the occasional sort of special occasion did they ever drink. That's an old myth. And then there was this whole leftist idea that we need to go into the commune and teach them how to live. And they don't know how to live because they're illiterate and they drink too much and all this stuff. But of course, that flies completely in the face of the actual facts. The communes and the journals that they published were Christian socialist in general. They were distributivist. They were strictly agrarian. They were extremely Christian and very ethnic in terms of their, Russians were a chosen people. The Russians were making war against Antichrist. I mean, this is the sort of thing that these guys must have been reading in the peasant journals and said, well, we must go in and educate them. So when you read the literature on this topic, you hear that the Russian populists wanted to build on the commune and they wanted to educate the peasants, but you need to decode that kind of rhetoric. The commune and the village was increasingly diverse in terms of its social life. You had a strong artisan class. You had a strong, obviously, agricultural class. You had a growing legal class based around the commune and the communal officials. All of this is growing. All of this is developing at the local level. And the fact is that if anything, Russians had an excess of democracy at the local level. You had at least three democratic institutions, the commune, the volost, and the zemstvo, that were constitutional and that were the overwhelming majority of the laws that these people had to maintain. The fact is that peasant property, peasant capitalism, the market was slowly developing. But because it was imposed by force by the state, it created this huge debt, and there was no ability to adjust. And then, of course, World War I broke out, and all of these reforms had to be put on hold. Needless to say that they were never continued because of what happened after the war. Okay, this has been a kind of a catch-all talk about the nature of Russian agrarianism and the peasant mentality after 1861, and to burst some of the myths and the BS that gets passed off as a scholarship in this field. It's one of the things that I'm on this planet to do, I'm proud to say. And I want to thank so many of my listeners who have donated to me. It's truly humbling. And really, it humbles me a lot because I just don't think I'm worthy of it, but clearly I'm having an impact with you, and that makes me very, very proud and very happy. You know that I do not claim a tax exemption from this, my chapel, my work here. I do not get supported by think tanks or big universities or even churches. I'm constantly running things on my own dime, on a shoestring, to make sure that my mission in terms of writing or radio or church life or liturgical life and everything continues to develop. And I'm doing it all pretty much by myself. And so any assistance you could give me, I truly appreciate it. And I've received some generous donations, and truly it's left me stupefied. So anyway, I appreciate you guys listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
To Radio Ariane.